for that reading. I'd like to do kind of a mini informal survey here. I'm curious how many of you have either bought exercise equipment of some kind, or you've joined a gym, or you've read some kind of a book or article on health or dieting or something like that. How many people could? I figured a number of people would fit that category here in the sanctuary, and probably many of you here who are watching this at home would as well. I'd like you to think back, for those of you that that applies to, think back to when that equipment came and you got it all set up, maybe in your, in your basement or a bedroom or wherever. Or think about touring that gym and seeing the Zumba room or whatever, the ellipticals, all the equipment. Or think back to, after you read that article, kind of going through your pantry and pulling some things out. That's probably going to have to go, and I don't think we're going to be able to eat that now. And your kids are starting to feel little panicked about, we've got the voice of God speaking to us from somewhere here. Your kids are feeling panicked that they're not going to be able to eat anything. If you can think back to that time, that situation, I wonder if just the process alone of experiencing those things started to make you feel healthier. And maybe you put on those new exercise clothes and kind of look at yourself in the mirror and thought, I think I'm even starting to look a little thinner already. But were you healthier? Were you thinner? Of course not, because you hadn't done anything yet for that to happen. Or if that's not your jam, how about this? Maybe some of you bought stuff at a home improvement store for a project. A paint, stain of some kind, tools, lumber and nails, whatever it is. And as you got that stuff and as you brought it home, you had this feeling of making progress. You could imagine what that project would look like when it was done. You could picture it in your mind. And I'm not going to ask if any of you still have stuff sitting around from that project that never got done. If there's still paint in the bucket, if the lumber is still sitting by the wall, the house doesn't look any better, does it? And yet we can feel like we are making progress just by having that stuff. Well, we begin a new series this morning, as you've already heard. The series is called Jesus in the Everyday. And here's my premise. How we relate to Jesus is not just a matter of beliefs in our head. It's not just a matter of intellectual ideas. How we relate to Jesus is not just a matter of how we feel about Jesus or some notion of being a spiritual person. How we relate to Jesus is not just about those things any more than, home projects are just about having the materials on hand, or exercise is just about, having your equipment. No, how we relate to Jesus is a matter of how we actually live our lives. God doesn't just care about some part of our lives that we think of as spiritual. He cares about the whole thing, every part of your life at home, your life at work or at school, the way that you use your money, how you handle yourself on the sports field, in all of those areas of life. God cares. How you live actually matters. God is interested in all of those things. So the question then becomes, how do we live in light of God's interest in all of those things? How do we live our lives? And to find an answer to that question, we turn to a very practical book of the Bible, the book of James. Now, James is not a book of soaring theology or high-minded doctrine. James is really kind of a very practical type of book. It comes from a family of literature in the Bible called wisdom literature, which is really about how you take what you know and apply it to your life. How do you live it out? How does what you know and what you believe affect what you actually do? That's the kind of thing that James is interested in. So we are going to work our way systematically through the book of James over these next weeks. Of course, if we're going to get through it in a reasonable amount of time, we're not going to be able to do a deep dive into every verse. But hopefully by the end, you'll have a good sense of the overview of what James is talking about, and you'll have maybe a new idea or be reminded of what it means for Jesus to be present and active in your life every day. So let's talk about James for a moment. The book of James is named for the author, whose name is James. He was one of probably the top three Christian leaders in the early church in the first century world. He was renowned for being kind of the leader of the mother church in Jerusalem, from which all of the other churches ultimately came. And James was renowned for being the half-brother of Jesus. He was a son of Mary and Joseph. Now, interestingly, during Jesus' earthly ministry, James didn't believe in him. Now, on one hand, that might be shocking. Member of Jesus' own family, in fact, all of the members of Jesus' family, it would seem, from what we have in the gospel accounts, did not believe in him, even thought he was crazy, during his earthly ministry. And on one hand, that might be shocking. On the other hand, what if you have a brother? What would your brother have to do to convince you that he is the Son of God? And on the other hand, maybe it makes perfect sense that James did not believe. And yet, we come to this letter, this book of James, really it's a letter from James, and he introduces himself as James, a servant of the Lord Jesus Christ. What is it that would help him to go from this perspective of, Jesus, his crazy brother, to Jesus, the Lord, and the Christ, of whom he was a servant? Well, it would be interesting to know the details of that, and the scriptures don't delve into that for us. They don't tell us the story of James's journey in that sense. But it was likely the resurrection of Jesus that made the difference. And 1 Corinthians 15 tells us that one of Jesus' post-resurrection appearances was to his brother James. What is it that would convince a man that his brother is the Savior of the world, the Son of God? Well, if you wanted to try to convince your brother of that, then try being dead for a couple days and then being raised to life again and coming back and having dinner with him. Just might do the trick. It did it for James. And in fact, James was so dedicated as a servant of his brother who became his Lord. He was so dedicated that the story is not in the scriptures, but it's commonly believed that James died as a martyr. That he was actually taken up to the top of the Jewish temple and was thrown off. And actually, he didn't die when he landed on the ground. And so a group gathered around him and beat him to death as he prayed for them. That's James. And we have this letter from him, probably one of the earliest New Testament writings written within a decade or two of when Jesus walked the earth. It's a letter to the 12 tribes scattered among the nations, which is just a way of referring to Israel, who most of the Christians of the day would have been Jews. And he's writing to them in difficult times, and we know that because he dives right in. You see that in verse 2. He dives right in to the topic of suffering. No subtlety, no setup, no inching his way in. He just jumps right in. And so we want to jump right in and talk about Jesus in our troubles, as he was in the troubles of the early church. And let me offer you a few suggestions about what that means for Jesus to be in the midst of them. Here's a first observation. Troubles are not a matter of if, but of when. They're not a matter of if, but of when. Though I love that the Bible does not sugarcoat matters like this. I love that it is gritty and it is gory at times. It is in touch with our real lives and it is true to life. And we do face trials of many kinds, don't we? All through our lives, we face trials of many kinds. When you're young, you can't wait to have the freedom and the privileges of adulthood. You know, kids get sick of the rules and the expectations and the chores, and they can't wait to be in high school, because then our troubles will be over. And then when you're in high school, you can't wait to graduate. By the time you get to your senior year, you're done with the teachers and the books and the curfews and the monotonous part-time job. And when high school is finally done, when you get through high school, then your troubles will be over. And so you will start your career, perhaps. And then you'll discover that with freedom comes responsibilities. Or you'll go to college and you'll discover that college is actually harder than high school was. But if you find that special someone and you get married, then your troubles will be over. Except, did she talk this much when we were dating? I don't really remember that. And, you know, her cooking isn't really like Mom's. Was he this much of a slob before we got married? I don't remember that. And he really, it seems like he isn't listening to me when I talk to him. He kind of gets this glazed over look. But once we have kids, then the troubles will be over. If only they weren't so needy all the time. Or if only they wouldn't grow up so fast. You know, once they're in school, then the troubles will be over. Once they're out of school, then the troubles will be over. Once they're done with college, once they have a career, once they find that special someone, once they give me grandkids, then the troubles will be over. Or maybe that's not your track. I mean, you know, maybe the it's not finding that special someone. Maybe it's that dream job. Maybe it's having that boat or that cabin. Maybe it's when you can travel. Maybe it's when you retire, then the troubles will be over. Except they never are. David Platt says this, "From our childhood home to the retirement home, trials are constant. It's not if, but when they come." You know, the Bible does include stories of God miraculously delivering his people from their troubles. And I love to read those stories. But as I get older, there's another kind of story that I find even more touching and powerful. And that's not necessarily God stepping in and miraculously delivering people out of their troubles. It's when God strengthens people to meet the troubles that they're in when they come. A little bit like, you know, that famous philosopher, Theodore Geisel, or maybe you know him as Dr. Seuss. He said, "I've heard there are troubles of more than one kind. Some come from ahead and some come from behind. But I've bought a big bat. I'm all ready, you see. Now my troubles are going to have troubles with me." How do you respond to your troubles? I don't know that James would advocate getting a big bat, but he does suggest a few other things. He says here, "Consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, when you face trials, troubles of many kinds." Troubles, he says, are an opportunity for joy. When they come, they're an opportunity for joy. Now, I don't like that very much. And it feels kind of like that contradicts what I just said about, you know, the Bible is so true to life. It's so realistic. That doesn't sound very realistic, does it? Troubles as a source of joy. And, you know, I wouldn't recommend that if you're trying to comfort someone who is in the midst of trouble, that you open up that verse and read it to them. Probably not the comfort they need in the moment. But beyond the emotions of the immediate situation, if we look at the bigger picture, maybe, just maybe, troubles are an opportunity for joy. James says here, consider it pure joy. Now, consider. Let's focus on that word for a moment. Consider is a thought word. It's a thought word. It's not a feelings word, primarily. So he's not saying, you know, when you're going through troubles, you know, try to make yourself feel happy. That's not what he's talking about. Because we have an awful time trying to control our feelings, don't we? What we can control are our thoughts. Where do your thoughts go in trouble? Why me? Why is this happening? When will this be over? Our thoughts go in all kinds of directions when we're in trouble. What if we fixed our minds on the idea that maybe there is joy, even pure joy, possible in the midst of trouble? And James doesn't leave us hanging here. He actually suggests some reasons why we might find joy when we're in the thick of troubles. And one of the reasons he suggests is this one. In addition to being an opportunity for joy, troubles are a pathway to maturity. They're a pathway to maturity. Verses 3 and 4, and you kind of have to follow his line of thought here. He says, you know that the testing of your faith produces perseverance. So he calls troubles or trials there. He says they're a test of your faith. They test your faith. Well, that must mean that faith is pretty important. Because, you know, you only test important things. When a teacher is going on and on and on in the classroom, what is the student's main question? Is this going to be on the test? You know, in other words, are you just kind of babbling on and on here, or is this actually something we need to know? Is it going to be on the test? You test important things. Faith, our trusting relationship with God, is an important thing that needs to be tested to prove, is this a genuine relationship? Is this a lasting relationship? I mean, is this just a fair weather, short-lived kind of thing, or is it really something that is valuable to you? When various troubles come, James says, that enables you in your faith to develop perseverance. Now, perseverance is another interesting word. It literally means to remain under, as if, you know, a person is under a heavy load. And I mean, they could drop the load at any time. They could let it go. They could give up. But they choose to stay under the load. They choose to keep holding it up. And that's what lasting faith does. It keeps holding up even under trouble. And like a muscle that's lifting weights, the faith that keeps holding up, that perseveres, can grow. Verse 4 says, perseverance will finish its work so that you will be mature and complete, not lacking anything. Maturity doesn't sound like a very sexy goal, does it? I mean, do we really want maturity? I'm not sure if I want maturity if it means I have to endure, if it means I have to persevere, if it means I have to put up with trouble or trials to get there. We want things to be easy, and if they're easy, then we'll keep the faith. Pastor Tim Keller makes this observation. He says that American society is probably the worst in history for preparing its members for suffering. It's a pretty strong statement, isn't it? The worst society in history for preparing people to go through suffering. Now, why is that? Well, you know, the predominant attitude seems to be, if you suffer, you need to sue. Because, somebody messed up, and therefore someone must pay, because it shouldn't be this way. We shouldn't have to suffer. We shouldn't have to put up with this. And yet that's not the way, interestingly enough, that's not the way that most societies in the world have viewed life and the world. Now, if you go back through history and you look at other societies, nearly all ancient people did not believe that this life and this world were all there was. They thought that this life, I mean, it's short and it is brutal, can be nasty at times, but there's another one coming, another life coming, another world coming that will be better than this one. And so if I don't have a lot of money in this life, if I don't have a lot of happiness in this life, there's still hope for the next. And so my goal then becomes to live in such a way in this life that I can have love and joy and happiness in those things in the next life. That's been the kind of the predominant mindset for most societies through history. Now we come to this present day, where their predominant view in our country and probably much of the Western world would seem to be, you know, this is all there is. So if you lose something here, if something is taken away from you, then hope is gone. Then it is lost. This is all you have. And the mindset that that creates is one that is deeply hurt by suffering. And yet, when we look at other areas of our lives, it's through troubles that we grow. I mean, it's through trouble that good things come. You know, can a baby learn to walk? If they never take a risk and topple over a bunch of times? Can you learn to ride a bike if you never fall and scrape your knee? I mean, in various places in life, we realize that this is how maturity comes. This is how we become complete. By pressing on, by hanging on, by holding up in the midst of trouble. Keller again says this: suffering equips you to do virtually everything you do much better. It can turbocharge the ordinary process of Christian growth. Suffering shows you your flaws. It teaches you humility and self-knowledge. It makes you empathetic toward other people. It teaches you all the traits necessary to be helpful to someone else. And it shows you that some things you thought you could not live without, you really can. Live without. If all we want is our troubles to be fixed, then we might struggle to find joy and certainly maturity. Troubles are also, they're a gut check of my reliance on Jesus. You know what a gut check is? I looked up that term. It's a test of a person's resolve, commitment, or priorities. You know, how resolved are you? What are you committed to? What are your priorities? Is relying on Jesus one of those priorities and commitments for you? I mean, it can be hard to rely on God when life is good. Aren't we quick to take the credit when life is good? You know, it's because I'm so nice, I'm so smart, I'm so hardworking, I'm so attractive. What, fill in the blank. We maybe don't think that consciously, and yet I wonder if that underlies our thought process. That's why things are going well. And then troubles come, and we look for someone to blame. God, how could you do this to me? I need wisdom to see life differently. I need wisdom just to, you know, to even see maturity as something that is worth seeking in the midst of trouble. James says, when we need wisdom, God is happy to give it to us. But then he says this. He says, when we ask, we need to believe and not doubt. That's verse 6. Or we shouldn't expect to receive anything from God. Now, if you've been around here for a few weeks, you know we just got done with a series of sermons on doubt. And one of my main points in that series was that doubt is not an altogether bad thing. Sounds like James disagrees, doesn't it? Believe and don't doubt, or you won't get anything from God. I mean, you know, take it all back. You know, get those sermons off of YouTube quickly. I think it's a matter of how we understand what he's talking about here. And the key is that phrase in verse 7, double-minded. When James talks about doubt, he's talking about being double-minded. What is that? Being double-minded is not about whether you're certain or not. When we think of doubt, we tend to think of you know, being uncertain. That's not what James is talking about here. He's talking about divided loyalties. He's talking about going in two directions at once. You want to go toward God, and at the same time, you want to go away from God. Divided loyalty. Do I trust God or don't I? Here's the thing. I can't have God as my anchor in the storms of life and something else as my anchor, because that's going to pull you in two different directions. So when my ultimate faith, and that's not what I say I believe, but what I really believe, when my ultimate faith is in something other than God, then what happens is I'm going to be rocked when I inevitably lose that thing. Or maybe it's a relationship. Maybe, like James deals with in verses 10 and 11, it's riches, it's money. Maybe, you know, maybe the thing that I'm really anchoring myself to is some temptation or sinful coping strategy, like he talks about in verse 13 and following. It's my reliance on Jesus, James would say, that will really help me to endure, to persevere, to find joy, to grow in the path toward maturity. So grab onto him. And here's the last suggestion for the morning. Your troubles do not define you. Your Creator and Redeemer does. Now, I know when you are in the midst of a trouble or trial, and some of you are probably right now, and when you're in the midst of it, it feels like that is all you can see, is the trouble, the trial, the testing. But there is so much more. Don't be deceived, my dear brothers and sisters, James writes. The one who perseveres under trial, he will receive the crown of life, the victor's crown in an athletic contest that the Lord has promised. Every good and perfect gift is from the Father of the heavenly lights who does not change. He brought us to life using the true word, and we out of all creation became his prized possession. This is what defines us. This is what matters most. Oh, we already sang it this morning. I am who you say I am. I receive the gifts that you give. Good and perfect gifts. And even when we're in trouble, there are many gifts. Relationships. Material provision, you know, whatever health we have. I mean, just five senses, taste and touch and smell and hearing and seeing. And there are spiritual blessings, the ultimate gift of life forever. These are the ultimate things. And when we're in trouble, they can bring joy. They can cause us to dig into the deeper realities of trust and maturity. They can make us more like the people we admire and more like the people we want to be. Dear brothers and sisters, when troubles of any kind come your way, consider it an opportunity for great joy as we look to God to do what only He can do. Would you pray with me? For some of us, God, we don't have to look too far to think about trouble because we are in the thick of it. For others, it's around the corner. For all of us, our troubles don't need to separate us from You. In fact, we can find joy. In fact, we can grow toward maturity. Our troubles don't have to define us as we rely on You. And so, even in a moment like this, as we pray, may we confess our need for You, God, in all things. When times are good and when they are not, we always need You. And You are willing to meet us in those hard places. We are never alone. And we can even praise You in the hard places as You sustain us, as You offer us good gifts, as You offer us most of all Yourself. And You have offered us Yourself in Jesus Christ, in His life, in His death, His sacrificial death for our sake, in His resurrection, life, and power. You have offered Him to us. May we rely on Him daily and so find what we need. In Your name, Jesus, I ask it. Amen.